Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm just back from a trip to Ecuador. Strolling the streets of Quito, enjoying the picturesque lanes, the basilicas, the domes, the charming squares. Of course, it all got me thinking about the incredible contributions of writers from South and Central America, Spain, and the Spanish Caribbean. It's a literary world filled with riches, which we'll explore today as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens has been a top design and sales studio for more than 20 years. Their professional designers come to your home, assess your space, your cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then they'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineer stone, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider a Lifestyle Kitchens gift certificate. Contact them today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's. lifestyleskitchens.com. The Book Report was thrilled to speak with Juno Diaz this past December. He and I discussed his new book, This Is How You Lose Her. But today we'll preview his earlier award-winning title, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. Things have never been easy for Oscar, a sweet but disastrously overweight, lovesick Dominican ghetto nerd. From his home in New Jersey, Oscar dreams of becoming the Dominican J.R.R. Tolkien, and most of all, of finding love. He may never get what he wants, thanks to the Fuku, the curse that has haunted Oscar's family for generations, dooming them to prison, torture, tragic accidents, and above all, ill-starred love. Oscar, still waiting for his first kiss, is just its most recent victim. Jonathan Davis and Stacy Snell narrate.
One of the 20th century's most infamous dictators ruled the Dominican Republic between 1930 and 1961 with an implacable, ruthless brutality. A portly, sadistic, pig-eyed mulatto who bleached his skin, wore platform shoes, and had a fondness for Napoleon-era haberdashery, Trujillo, also known as El Jefe, the failed cattle thief, came to control nearly every aspect of the DR's political, cultural, social, and economic life through a potent and familiar mixture of violence, intimidation, massacre, rape, co-optation, and terror. Treated the country like it was a plantation, and he was the master. At first glance, your prototypical Latin American caudillo. But his power was terminal in ways that few historians or writers have ever truly captured, or I would argue, imagined. He was our Sauron, our Aron, our dark side, our once and future dictator. A personaje so outlandish, so perverse, so dreadful, that not even a sci-fi writer could have made his up. Famous for changing all the names of all the landmarks in the Dominican Republic to honor himself. Pico Duarte became Pico Trujillo, and the Santo Domingo de Guzmán, the first and oldest city in the New World, became Ciudad Trujillo. For making ill monopolies out of every slice of the national patrimony, which quickly made him one of the wealthiest men on the planet. For building one of the largest militaries in the hemisphere. For insisting on absolute veneration from his pueblo. Tellingly, the national slogan was Dios y Trujillo. For running the country like it was a marine boot camp. For stripping friends and allies of their positions and properties for no reason at all. And for his almost supernatural abilities. Outstanding accomplishments include the 1937 genocide against the Haitian and Haitian-Dominican community. One of the longest, most damaging U.S.-backed dictatorships in the Western Hemisphere, And if we Latin types are skillful at anything, it's tolerating U.S.-backed dictators. So you know this was a hard-earned victory. The Chilenos and the Argentinos are still appealing. The creation of the first modern kleptocracy. Trujillo was Mobutu before Mobutu was Mobutu. The systematic bribing of American senators. And, last but not least, the forging of the Dominican peoples into a modern state. Did what his Marine trainers during the occupation were unable to do. No one knows whether Trujillo was the curse's servant or its master, its agent or its principal. But it was clear he and it had an understanding, that them two was tight. It was believed, even in educated circles, that anyone who plotted against Trujillo would incur a fuku most powerful, down to the seventh generation and beyond. If you even thought a bad thing about Trujillo, fwa! A hurricane would sweep your family out to sea. Fwa! A boulder would fall out of a clear sky and squash you. Fwa! The shrimp you ate today was the cramp that killed you tomorrow. Which explains why everyone who tried to assassinate him always got done. Why those dudes who finally did buck him down all died so horrifically.
We've just heard The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Juno Diaz. Sandra Cisneros was born in Chicago, the only daughter in a family of seven children. She studied at Chicago's Loyola University and received an MFA in creative writing at the University of Iowa. Sandra worked as a teacher and counselor to high school dropouts, taught creative writing, and has been a visiting writer at a number of universities, including Berkeley and the University of Michigan. Her books include poetry, a collection of stories, and two novels. The House on Mango Street, first published in 1984, is required reading in middle schools, high schools, and universities across the country. There are over 2 million copies in print. In 1995, Sandra was awarded the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, and she subsequently organized the Latino MacArthur Fellows, Los Macoturos, focusing on community outreach. In 2003, she was awarded the Texas Medal of the Arts. She is the president and founder of the Macondo Foundation, an association of socially engaged writers working to advance creativity, foster generosity, and honor our communities. Her newest title is Have You Seen Marie? A picture book for grown-ups. Welcome, Sandra. It's such an honor to have you here on the Book Report.
Al contrario, I'm grateful to be able to talk about books with you.
Have You Seen Marie is, on the surface, a story about a search for a missing cat, but it's truly a story of loss, grief, and community. I found it brilliant. Talk about your inspiration for sharing your message in this way.
Well, it was originally written as a short story, and I thought it was going to be part of my forthcoming collection that I'm still working on. But I was reading it out loud when I was on the road for my last book, and I noticed that it was having a profound effect on my listeners. You can tell when you're reading something that's having an impact because the audience becomes very quiet or their eyes just well up with tears and they just come up to you and say, oh, I felt like you wrote that for me. And I always say, I did. I wrote that for you because you write it as medicine. I think of books as being medicine, and I could see that this was a very potent medicine and that it needed to be its own little book, not part of a collection where it could get lost, but it needed to be available as a little book that you could give to someone who was in a state of grief or they could buy it for someone else they knew who was suffering from having their heart broken open.
What made you think of a picture book for adults?
Well, I'm always doing kind of wacky things in my forms and the books that I write. They kind of always go into border zones. And I thought of this as being a small book, but I thought it would be nice as a gift book. And when you give someone a gift, it's nice to have another art in there. And my friend Esther Hernandez, a very famous artist, had just lost her mom. And I'm in a time in my life now, I'm close to 58, that I thought, well, you know, I like collaborating with my friends. She just lost her mom, and I sent her the story to help heal her, and I suggested maybe she would like to do a little project with me. I don't remember asking her more than once, but she said I asked her about half a dozen times. Probably that's true. But eventually she was persuaded. I think she was a little intimidated by the idea of doing a book. She's not a book illustrator. She's a fine artist. She's done a lot of political posters and a lot of political art to help heal people in the San Joaquin Valley, the United Farm Workers group. And so I knew that, you know, she had the kind of heart that would understand the story. And eventually she came around.
It is beautifully illustrated. Early in the book, you write about being a midlife orphan. Your mother died when you were 53. I had the same experience. Your book really resonated with me. My mother died when I was 47, and I still feel like an orphan. I have to believe that this has really resonated with so many of your readers.
Well, it resonated for me because I'd lost my father 10 years prior, and I thought I knew what to expect when death came. I thought I had it all under control. I'd learned that ritual already. I knew what was coming. But my mother's death really took me by surprise. One, she wasn't ill, and she just suddenly passed away. And two, I wasn't expecting the great loss I had. I think losing your mom is a primordial fear we have since the time we're little infants. I think we're children, and we howl like banshees when we lose our mother in the supermarket. So imagine how you feel as an adult when you've lost your mom, that mother root. And I think especially for daughters, because we have such difficult relationships with our mothers. I know that I was very difficult for my mother, and my mother was very difficult for me. So it wasn't a perfect relationship. I think there was a lot of unresolved issues. And her crossing was just left me still to this day that I miss her every day, that I see something in a bookstore that I want to buy her, or a piece of jewelry in a museum shop that I wish I could buy to make her happy. She was not a woman who was happy at the end of her life. And I think her children tried to buy her things to make her happy, not understanding that her sadness was something very old from before we were born.
In the afterword of the book, you write that love does not die. We can continue to receive and give love after death. Can you talk more about that?
Well, I think that's one of the great things I learned first with my father's death and later with my mother, that if you haven't resolved issues with someone who's in spirit form, you don't have to live with regret. You can still communicate and resolve those issues when they're in spirit. Because I know from my own experience of meditating that I can still give and feel viscerally my father and my mother's love. That's so astounding and amazing to me. Not everybody can feel it, but I do. And I'm always surprised that everyone else doesn't feel it. What? You don't feel that? It feels kind of like when you see a beautiful flower or a beautiful mountain or hear a beautiful symphony, and suddenly your heart just is filled with this current of light, and you think, oh, I feel like crying from happiness. That's what it feels like. And I feel it when I'm in just the right zone of meditating. If I'm lucky and if I'm quiet and if I'm by myself, I can get to that zone where I can communicate and receive and give my mother and father love, even though they're no longer a physical presence.
I loved when you wrote, there is no getting over death, just walking alongside it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, people say, oh, time heals everything. No, that's not true. Time does not heal everything. I think when you lose someone that you so deeply love, you just learn how to accommodate it in your life. You know that it's there, and you make friends with that sadness.
Talk about the Macondo Foundation.
The Macondo Foundation is a collective of writers who I worked with for the last 15 years. It was a workshop that gathered at first in my dining room and later in San Antonio, Texas. It's still in existence as a collective of socially minded writers who apply to gain admittance, and we assist each other. We're kind of like a family of writers with the same idea that writing should serve community.
What are some of your reflections about the recent presidential election and this such an important voice of Hispanic people?
Well, I think one of the wonderful things is that we realize, like in Horton Hears a Who, we are here and we count. I think that that's the most amazing thing, even to ourselves as a community, that we count. We are here. We've always been made to feel we are not here and we don't count.
What's next for you?
Well, for me, I've got several new books on the burners, and some are almost done and some are done. I have a collection of essays that I'm editing. I have a new collection of poetry on a very back burner on Simmer. I have short fiction, and I'm looking to wrap up my stay in Texas.
Aren't people clamoring for another novel?
I think I'm a miniaturist, and that's my forte, and that's what I love to do best. And I'm always looking for the evolution of Sandra Cisneros. I care about doing the work that's going to help me to understand myself and that's going to be the best use of my talent on behalf of trying to heal the planet. I'd like to just remind all our readers that my new book is Have You Seen Marie? It's a picture book for adults and children, but it's especially for adults. Children like the story about the cat, and adults like the story about the lost mother.
And I loved about the community, how very different everybody was, but yet how there was so much cohesion.
Well, I was trying to draw a picture of my community, the couple blocks that I live in, the Texas that I know. Most people think of Texas in a different way. And I felt from living there 25 years, these are the people I know and who are my neighbors and who I know intimately. And I wanted to destroy the kind of stereotypes of Texana literature that people have in their heads when they think about Texana.
Well, Sandra, I loved your book. It was beautiful and very inspirational. And as I said, really resonated with me. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Elaine. I appreciate the time.
And now let's hear a sample of Have You Seen Marie, narrated by the author.
The neighbor Luli walked by with her pets following behind her in single file like a parade. A cat, a chihuahua, and a dog as fat as a brown bear. Luli has witnessed too much grief for one lifetime and has a teardrop etched near her left eye to prove it. But no, she hadn't seen Marie.
"Isn't it a shame to lose the one you love?" Luli asked.
"Yes, it is," I agreed. And when I said it, my heart felt as if someone squeezed it. The day grew hot. The top of our heads felt soft as tar. On San Arturo Street, a grandmother watering her thirsty roses told us no, she hadn't seen Marie. "Would you mind watering us, please?" We pointed to our heads. She did, laughing as she sent a lazy jump rope of water towards us. At a lacy Victorian on Barrera Street, we stopped to chat with a woman pretty as a mermaid. She was swinging on a porch swing, knitting something purple. I thought about my mother and how she used to knit ugly scarves no one wanted to wear. Now I wish I had one of those ugly scarves, and my nose started to tingle. Under the shadow of the Hemisphere Tower, at a wooden house off Refugio and Matagorda, a nice couple dining on their porch invited us to look into their bamboo. There was a family of wildcats living there, but the cats wouldn't answer when we asked about Marie, except for a fat gray one with eyes like hubcaps who curled its tail into a question mark. We left with paper plates of brisket, beans, potato salad, and cups of iced tea. Outside the doors of the Torres Taco Haven, we caught up with John the mailman, who knows everything about everything in the neighborhood. John let his mailbag slide off his shoulder, readjusted his cap, and then announced, "Nope, can't say I've seen any black and white cat. But I know a lady over on Beauregard whose cat just had kittens." "Have you seen Marie?" Anne, the artist, lives next door to the gas station. We found her planting paper whites in her front yard in memory of her mother. We didn't say much to each other, but that said everything.
Marie! Marie!
We called up to trees. We crawled on our hands and knees and peered under parked cars. We walked behind houses and into scratchy, deserted gardens. But there was no Marie to be found. At a tiny house on Claudia Street, with a Virgen de Guadalupe nicho in the front yard, silver women in their silver years laughed like bells. I felt better for a little while.
May la Virgen look over you, honey bunnies, and your kitty cat, too.
Marie, Marie, we shouted.
But inside my heart wheezed, Mama, Mama. The sky let out a sigh and soured into a bruise. Wind whirled the flyers we had left in dry, hot circles, and big, sad drops of rain began, as if to say, despair, despair.
Oh, Marie, Rosalind said out loud, I miss you.
I said nothing but swallowed. A woman named Beverly called out to us from the corner house on Crofton, the one with the 5 palm trees.
Hey, I think I found your Marie. Hallelujah and amen. Bless the Reverend Giovanna, Rosalind said.
But when we went to look, it was a big male cat with a white face and black body.
Who knew there were so many tuxedo cats in the neighborhood?
Aw, sweetie, Beverly said. I'm so sorry, and hugged Rosalind. I felt like asking for a hug, too.
That was Have You Seen Marie by Sandra Cisneros.
Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens has been a top design and sales studio for more than 20 years. Their professional designers come to your home, assess your space, your cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then they'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineer stone, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider a Lifestyle Kitchens gift certificate. Contact them today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's 2 S's. lifestyleskitchens.com. Carlos Ruiz Zafón is a Spanish novelist whose 2001 work, The Shadow of the Wind, won numerous awards. His next novel, The Angel's Game, which we'll preview today, is actually the prequel. The book is set in Barcelona during the 1920s and 30s. It follows and is narrated by David Martin, a young writer approached by a mysterious figure to write a book. It begins with David receiving a letter from a reclusive French editor, Andrés Corelli, who makes him the offer of a lifetime. He is to write a book unlike anything that has ever existed, a book with the power to change hearts and minds. In return, he'll receive a fortune, and perhaps more. But as David begins the work, he realizes there is a connection between his haunting book and the shadows that surround him. Dan Stevens narrates.
I followed Don Basilio through a wide hall with fine wood panelling. On one side was a circular room with a large round table and a series of portraits from which we were observed by an illustrious group of frowning members of the aristocracy.
The room for the witches' sabbaths, Don Basilio explained. All the section heads meet here with a deputy editor, yours truly, and the editor, and like good knights of the round table, we find the Holy Grail every evening at 7 o'clock. Impressive. You ain't seen nothing yet, said Don Basilio, winking at me. Look at this.
Don Basilio stood beneath one of the august portraits and pushed the wooden panel covering the wall. The panel yielded with a creak, leading to a hidden corridor.
What do you say, Martin? And this is only one of the many secret passages in the building. Not even the Borgias had a set-up like this.
I followed Don Basilio down the corridor, and we reached a large reading room surrounded by glass cabinets, the repository of La Vanguardia's secret library. At one end of the room, under the beam emanating from a lampshade of green glass, a middle-aged man was sitting at a table, examining a document with a magnifying glass. When he saw us come in, he raised his head and gave us a look that would have made anyone young enough, or sensitive enough, turn to stone.
"Let me introduce you to José María Breton, Lord of the Underworld, Chief of the Catacombs of this holy house," Don Basilio announced.
Without letting go of the magnifying glass, Breton observed me with his eyes that seemed to go rusty on contact. I went up to him and shook his hand.
"This is my old apprentice, David Martin."
Breton reluctantly shook my hand and glanced at Don Basilio. "Is this the writer?"
"The very one."
Breton nodded. "He's certainly courageous, stepping out into the street after the thrashing they gave him. What's he doing here?"
"He's come to plead for your help, your blessing and advice on an important matter of documental archaeology,"
Don Basilio explained. "And where's the blood sacrifice?" Breton spat out. I swallowed. "Sacrifice?" I asked. Breton looked at me as if I were an idiot. A goat, a lamb, a capon if pressed. My mind went blank. For an endless moment, Breton kept his eyes fixed on mine without blinking. Then, just as I started to feel the prickle of sweat down my back, the archivist and Don Basilio roared with laughter. I let them laugh as much as they wanted at my expense until they couldn't breathe and had to dry their tears. Clearly, Don Basilio had found a soulmate in his new colleague. "Come this way, young man," Breton said, doing away with his fierce countenance. "Let's see what we can find." The newspaper archives were located in one of the basements, under the floor that housed the huge rotary press, a product of post-Victorian technology. It looked like a cross between a monstrous steam engine and a machine for making lightning.
"Let me introduce you to the rotary press, better known as Leviathan. Mind how you go. They say it's already swallowed more than one unsuspecting person," said Don Basilio. "It's like the story of Jonah and the whale, only what comes out again is mincemeat."
"Surely you're exaggerating. One of these days we could throw in that new trainee, the smart aleck who likes to say that print is dead," Breton proposed.
"Set a time and a date and we'll celebrate with a stew,"
Don Basilio agreed. They both laughed like schoolchildren. Birds of a feather, I thought. The archive was a labyrinth of corridors bordered by 3-meter-high shelving. A couple of pale creatures who looked as if they hadn't left the cellar in 15 years officiated as Breton's assistants. When they saw him, they rushed over like loyal pets awaiting instructions. Breton looked at me inquisitively. "What is it we're looking for?" 1904. The death of a lawyer called Diego Marlaska, a pillar of Barcelona society, founding member of the Valera Marlaska y Sentis legal firm. "Month?" "November." At a signal from Breton, the two assistants ran off in search of copies dating back to November 1904. It was a time when each day was so stained with the presence of death that most newspapers ran large obituaries on their front pages. A character as important as Marlaska would probably have generated more than a simple death notice in the city's press, and his obituary would have been front cover material.
That was The Angels Game by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. Carlos Fuentes, Mexico's grand man of letters, died last year at the age of 83. Fuentes was a catalyst, along with Gabriel García Márquez and Mario Vargas Llosa, of the explosion of Latin American literature in the 60s and 70s, known as El Boom. Fuentes' plays, short stories, political nonfiction, and novels won him widespread acclaim. In 1985, Fuentes received recognition in the U.S. with his novel The Old Gringo, a tale about the American writer Ambrose Bierce, who disappeared during the Mexican Revolution. It was the first book by a Mexican novelist to become a bestseller north of the border and was made into a 1989 film starring Gregory Peck and Jane Fonda. Fuentes made his voice heard through his literature. He did so prolifically and inventively, tracing the history of modern Mexico in layered stories that also explored universal themes of love, memory, and death. Today, the book report brings you Happy Families, 16 vignettes of families from the Mexican presidential palaces to middle-class apartments to the places of the poor. In the language of the street and in straightforward, elegant prose, Fuentes gives us stories connected by love and sometimes the failure of love. Jimmy Garcia and Vilma Silva perform the work.
You're still with me because there's nobody left but me who remembers your beauty. Only I have your young eyes and my old ones. Time belongs to me. He doesn't understand it. I close my eyes and time belongs to me. We're alone, you and I, husband and wife, newlyweds. We don't need anything. You don't let anyone in. Other people spoil everything. Only you and I, lost in an endless embrace. Chained dog barking in the courtyard, only sound in the area. Your yellow dress, tossed over a chair, the only light. I don't have the words. How strange. We talk a great deal. Inside, I'm silent. There were misunderstandings. I made a date with you for 12 o'clock.
What? You said 2.
No, 12. Write down your dates. Dates? How many do you have in a day? With whom? With how many people? Why do you provoke my jealousy with equivocal answers? You always knew I was jealous. You even liked it. I liked to feel jealous. That's what you told me. And why didn't you ever make me feel jealous with another woman? What? You were always faithful, or didn't you have the imagination? I was busy with my career. I never had time for chasing after women. I was absorbed in my work. You know that. I wanted to get ahead. For you. For me. For our marriage. For the two of us. I had ambitions.
You know her. Nobody knows her better than you. But now you wouldn't recognize her. How could she be? Doña Medea Batalla stripped? A mature woman, 60, 70 years old, naked in a police cell? The gray-haired grandmother without clothes except for a diaper pinned on her, you say? Her chest defeated as if by a too frequent haughtiness? Thin, strong arms accustomed to work and not to penitence? What work, you ask? In the neighborhood, many occupations are attributed to Doña Mede, who begins her back and forth at the market very early in the day. She wants to be the first to choose the potatoes and dried chilies and grasshoppers and locusts in season. Then she withdraws to her one-story house between a tire repair shop and a hardware store at the rear of a parking garage and takes the real treasure from her rebozo, a snake rattle. Doña Mede knows she survives thanks to the rattle, which is a potion for long life. Each snake has 5 rattles. With 2 doses a week, you enjoy good health. This is a secret you may not have known, and I'm telling you now so you can begin to understand. Because in the case of Doña Mede, everything is supposition and guesswork, since she makes a point of keeping, concealing, her secrets inside her rebozo, allowing neighborhood gossip to fly. They say she's a seamstress. Haven't you seen her go into the house with a bundle of clothes and then come out with packages that could be shirts or blouses or skirts? Or she's a potter. Have you heard her turn the wheel and then go out to wash the clay from her hands at the faucet outside her house? Or a midwife? Where does she go in such a hurry when a little kid from the neighborhood comes running and says, "Come, Doña Medea, come now, hurry, my sister's yelling," and says you should come and help her? Or a witch, a Protestant preacher, a procurer for non-existent local millionaires, and more miracles are hung on her than the ones she gives thanks for with constant special ex votos to the Virgin here in the Church of the Immaculate Conception.
We've just heard Happy Families by Carlos Fuentes. Roberto Ampuero is an award-winning author. Born in Chile, Ampuero is a professor of creative writing at the University of Iowa. He also serves as Chile's ambassador to Mexico. Ampuero has published 11 novels in Spanish, but The Neruda Case is his first novel published in English. Isabel Allende has called the book a sweeping mystery set against the backdrop of the Chilean coup. And Puero's writing is exhilarating. He is a delight to read. Welcome, Roberto. It's great to have you visiting us on the Book Report.
Thank you very much for this invitation.
When I traveled to Chile, I also visited La Sebastiana, the house of Pablo Neruda, high on the hill in Valparaiso. Can you describe it for our listeners?
Well, this is an old house. It's at the top of one of the hills in Valparaiso, overlooking the sea and the bay, the Pacific Ocean. Interesting is that Pablo Neruda bought this house, and it was when he bought it, it was a small house. And after a while, he started improving the house, enlarging the house. He always did the same in the houses he owned in Chile. He was a poet who was very, very lucky as well. He was good and lucky because he earned a lot of money. And so he started with small houses, and they grew with the time based on the needs he had. And that's why it's a very, very special house, the Neruda house in Valparaiso.
Yeah. Introduce us to Cayetano Brulé.
Okay, Cayetano Brulé. Well, first thing, this Neruda case is the sixth novel of Cayetano Brulé, but this is a novel that tells about the origins, the beginning of Cayetano Brulé as a private eye, as a detective. Cayetano Brulé was born in Havana in Cuba. And then when he was older, around 20, 25, he went to Chile, to live in Chile, in the time of the government of Salvador Allende. Cayetano Brulé was born in Havana, lived for a while in Miami and Key West, and then he went to Valparaiso. He's an international guy. He's a cosmopolitan character. And he lives in Valparaiso, in a hill, and all his cases are related to moving around the world. Neruda, Pablo Neruda, the poet, is the person who made him into a detective. This first story about Cayetano Brulé starts with a call, more or less, from Pablo Neruda to him, the poet calling the detective, the old poet calling the young detective, and telling him he needs some help from him. And after a while, he realizes what is going on. Cayetano Brulé told him, Mr. Poet, dear Pablo Neruda, okay, I'm fine, I'm very honored to work for you, but I am not really a detective, and what you are asking me for is a very difficult task. And Neruda said, you know, you don't need to be a real detective. I will lend you a couple of novels written by Georges Simenon about Inspector Maigret. And since literature teaches a lot about life, you will learn, you will be able to represent me in this case and to look for the person I want you to find.
I'm a student of political science, but I think many of my fellow Americans are either forgetful or neglectful. Talk a little about the coup that is so right. Central to the book. Refresh our memories.
Okay. Well, yes, of course. First thing we have to perhaps to remember that in this from 1970 to 1973, there was in Chile a socialist democratic president called Salvador Allende. And this book is set in that time. Allende wanted to start a revolution in Chile, and he had the support of the international left as well, and the international left. And it was because of this, and it fell in a controversy and a conflict, not a military conflict, but an economic and political conflict with the United States, with President Nixon and Henry Kissinger. So the economic situation of Chile became bad, very bad. Allende, who wanted to build a socialist society, was an idealist person, I would say. He thought the Soviet Union would help him in that time. But at that time, Soviet Union had a lot to do with Cuba. It was very expensive for the Soviet Union to support Cuba, and they were not interested in supporting Chile as well. So Allende, the socialist government, had not only problems with the United States, but also problems with Western Europe. And so no support in economic terms, no trade. And on the other side, the Soviet Union, all the communist countries were not supporting Chile. So he started to have a very difficult time in Chile with polarization, political polarization in Chile and division in the country. And this ended up in a military coup. A dictator took power. It was Augusto Pinochet. And Salvador Allende died in the Moneda, Palace in our White House. And this young detective had to travel from Chile at that time to Mexico, also to Cuba under Fidel Castro, and then to East Germany behind the wall at the time. And so he went further to Bolivia and related to the guerrilla of Che Guevara in Bolivia. It's a novel about, I would say, love that Pablo Neruda, the poet, lost several years ago. It's about also politics, it's about mystery, and it's about moving around the world during the time of the Cold War.
You say in your book, life is nothing more than a parade of disguises. Tell us more about that. Uh-huh.
Well, Pablo Neruda liked to dress and have he had a lot of disguises, and when he invited friends and colleagues, very famous around the world, poets from all over the world, he organized always a kind of surprise. Nobody knew about when would he appear. He had different secret doors in some of his houses, and suddenly he would open the doors and appear there in disguise. It's a very interesting part of his life. In the Neruda case, in my novel, he teaches Cayetano when he says, you know, it doesn't matter if you are not a detective. You know, you can be something else, someone else. It's up to you. You have to decide to do so. And if I give you some information, or in another case, a disguise, you will be the person you want to be. And this is a kind of technique at the same time for a detective. But at the same time, this is a kind of, it's a very important exercise, I think, for a novelist, perhaps for a poet as well, because we are different voices when we write. This is a kind of, as well, of a disguise.
Will you ever write a Cayetano Brulé novel solely in Florida?
I have written 6 novels about Cayetano Brulé, and I think in 3 of them he comes to Florida, to the Key West, to Miami, and so on. Also, another novels, he goes to New York City and to Chicago. But this Florida and then Miami and Key West is a good place for Cayetano Brulé, my detective, because he was born in Havana, and this they're sharing common characteristics between both, I would say, Havana and Miami, language and culture and music and food and all that.
You write in Spanish. I've always wondered how involved an author is with the translation and how that process feels.
Okay. You know, well, I have published 13 novels, and they are translated into 12 languages, also in China, in Mandarin, and in Taiwan. So, you know, I decided to give up about the translations because, well, I can check the translation. I can enjoy the translations and read the translations in English, for example, or in Portuguese, or in German. I can do that because German is my second language. But I give it up because sometimes I receive the books in Italian or in Greek or in Mandarin. There is nothing I can do with that. You only can trust in the name of the publishing house and translators they hire. In these novels, Cayetano travels a lot around the world. It is not by chance that I decided that he has to go to Moscow or St. Petersburg or have Berlin or Havana or Miami. It's part of a very important part of the novel, because I think cities and scenarios are as important as characters. They are real. In reality, they are characters. The Neruda case is the first novel published in the United States in English. And I'm very happy. This is a wonderful copy in the Neruda case. The translation I have heard is very, very good. Carolina de Robertis, a very distinguished writer, writer and translator. So I'm very happy with that. And I hope, since I live in the United States, that I can keep this bridge to readers in English. Because I don't write in English. I can read a lot of in English, but I can't write in English.
Well, I so enjoyed the book. It's really draws you in. And as you say, the settings are so evocative. They are another character. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And now we'll listen to a preview of the Neruda case, performed by Robertson Dean.
In any case, the illustrious Almagro and Ruggiero would have to be patient, Cayetano Brulé concluded as he adjusted the knot of his tie, which was bright purple with little green guanacos, and waited for the waitress, a pale goth girl with jet-black hair and black clothing, who wore a Kanye West-style headset to communicate with the kitchen. He unfolded the local newspaper and read on the front page about the defeat of the long-suffering soccer team, the Wanderers, the slashed throat of a model in the gardens of the Viña del Mar casino, and the alarming rise of unemployment in the region. This last piece of information didn't surprise him. The decline of Valparaiso was no secret. In the 19th century, it had been the most important and prosperous port on the Pacific. Enrico Caruso and Sarah Bernhardt acted in its theaters. Gatti Chavez and exclusive European boutiques opened along its streets, and a quarter of its population, being foreign, spoke no Spanish. But a ferocious earthquake on the night of August 16, 1906, devastated the city and buried more than 3,000 of its inhabitants under the rubble of buildings, houses, and mansions, all in a matter of seconds. That same night, thousands of people abandoned the city for good, and those who remained began, from that moment on, to live by evoking the splendor and glitter of the past, the beauty of the disappeared city, convinced that in some not-too-distant future a miracle would restore the march of progress. But just one day short of 8 years later, that same progress dealt them another brutal blow, the opening of the Panama Canal, which was celebrated on August 15, 1914, and strangled Valparaiso. The bay became desolate overnight. The warehouses in the port went empty. The cranes stood still on the wharf, and the bars, shops, and restaurants closed their doors forever, casting employees, whores, and pimps into permanent unemployment. Without any knowledge of this tragic history, of this unending decline, which seemed more like a deliberate divine punishment than the result of random fate, and captivated by the delirious architecture and topography of the city and the affable and taciturn nature of its inhabitants, Cayetano decided to settle in Valparaiso when he arrived in Chile in 1971 on the arm of Maria Paz Ángela Undaraga Cox, his wife at the time. Those were the days of Salvador Allende and Unidad Popular, as well as of an unbridled social turmoil that would lead not to what the people dreamed of, but rather to the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. How many years had passed since then? Since the start of that period that so many preferred to forget? 30-odd years? In any case, the people of this port city, or porteños, ever dignified, and he now considered himself one of them, believed that good and bad luck crouched, waiting around any corner or just beyond the curve of some stone staircase, and for that reason everything in the world was relative and fleeting.
We've just heard The Neruda Case by Roberto Ampuero. Luis Alberto Urrea is an acclaimed writer who uses his dual culture life experiences to explore themes of love, loss, and triumph. Born in Tijuana to a Mexican father and an American mother, Urrea has published extensively. The Devil's Highway, his 2004 nonfiction account of a group of Mexican immigrants lost in the Arizona desert, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. The Hummingbird's Daughter is the story of Teresa Urrea, sometimes known as the Mexican Joan of Arc. The book involved 20 years of research and writing. It's set in 1889, when Mexico's Civil War was brewing.
16-year-old Teresita, the illegitimate but beloved daughter of a wealthy and powerful rancher, wakes from a strange dream, a dream where she has died. But it is not a dream. This passionate and rebellious young woman seems to have arisen from the dead with the power to heal. It will take all her faith to endure the trials that await her as the Saint of Cabora. The author narrates.
The people were already setting out the dead's favorite corn husk cigarettes, and if they could not afford tobacco, they filled the cigarros with machuche, which would burn just as well and only make the smokers cough a little. Grandmother's thimble, grandfather's old bullets, pictures of father and mother, a baby's umbilical cord in a crocheted pouch. They saved up their centavos to buy loaves of ghost bread and sugar skulls with blue icing on their foreheads, spelling out the names of the dead they wished to honor, though they could not read the skulls. And the confectioners often couldn't read them either, an alphabet falling downstairs. Tomas Urrea, the master of the rancho, along with his hired cowboys, thought it was funny to note the grammatical atrocities committed by the candy skulls. Martia, Jorge, Octavio. The vaqueros laughed wickedly, though most of them couldn't read either. Still, they were not about to lead Don Tomas to think they were brutos. A poem, Tomas announced. Oh, no, said his best friend, Don Lauro Aguirre, the great engineer on one of his regular visits. There once was a young man from Guamuchil, Tomas recited. And, said Don Lauro, I haven't worked it out yet. Tomas rode his wicked black stallion through the frosting of starlight that turned the ranch blue and pale gray as if powdered sugar had blown off the sky and sifted over the mangoes and mesquites. Most of the citizens of Sinaloa had never wandered more than 100 miles. He had traveled more than anyone else, 107 miles. An epic journey undertaken 5 days before, when he and his foreman, Segundo, had led a squad of armed outriders to Los Mochis, then to the Sea of Cortes beyond, all to collect Don Lauro Aguirre, arriving by ship from far Mazatlan, and with him a shipment of goods for the ranch, which they contracted for safe delivery in a conducta wagon train accompanied by cavalry. In Los Mochis, Tomas had seen the legendary object called the sea. More green than blue, he'd noted to his companions, already an expert on first sight. The poets are wrong. Poets, said Segundo, hating all versifiers and psalmists. They had gone on to greet the engineer at the docks. He fairly danced off the boat, so charged with delight was he, to be once again in the rustic arms of his bon ami très enchanté. Under his arm, carefully wrapped in oilcloth, Aguirre clutched a leather-bound copy of Maxwell's treatise on electricity and magnetism. In Aguirre's opinion, the Scotsman had written a classic. Don Lauro had a nagging suspicion that electricity, this occult force, and magnetism, certainly a force of spirit, could be used to locate and even affect the human soul. In his pocket, a greater wonder was hidden, a package of Adam's Black Jack chewing gum, the indescribable flavor of licorice. Wait until Tomas tasted that. The ship looked to Segundo like a fat bird with gray wings floating on the water after eating some fish. He was delighted with himself and pointed to the boat and told one of the buckaroos, fat bird, ate some fish, floating around.
That was The Hummingbird's Daughter by Luis Alberto Urrea. Author Arturo Perez Reverte is a celebrated master of smart, gripping thrillers, comparable to such literary legends as Herman Melville, Joseph Conrad, and Patrick O'Brien. Translated into 19 languages, his books have sold more than 3 million copies worldwide. If you are not yet familiar with his work, the Book Report is pleased to introduce you to The Nautical Chart. At a maritime auction in Barcelona, Merchant Marine Officer Manuel Coy sees an intense bidding war erupt over a seemingly innocuous 18th century atlas. The auction winner is the beautiful Tanger Soto, who is obsessed with a Jesuit ship sunk by pirates in the 17th century. Joining forces, Tanger and Manuel hit the seas in search of De Gloria and its precious yet unidentified cargo. Their quest sends them not only into dangerous waters, but also into the perilous recesses of the human heart. George Guidel narrates this masterful romance of the sea.
We could call him Ishmael, but in truth his name is Coy. I met him in the next-to-last act of this story, when he was on the verge of becoming just one more shipwrecked sailor floating on his coffin as the whaler Rachel looked for lost sons. By then, he had already been drifting some, including the afternoon when he came to the Claymore Auction Gallery in Barcelona with the intention of killing time. He had a small sum of money in his pocket, and in a room in a boarding house near the Ramblas, a few books, a sextant, and a pilot's license that 4 months earlier the head office of the Merchant Marine had suspended for 2 years after the Isla Negra, a 40,000-ton container ship, had run aground in the Indian Ocean at 0420 hours, on his watch. Coy liked auctions of naval objects, although in his present situation he was in no position to bid. But Claymore's, located on a first floor on Calle Concel de Cent, was air-conditioned and served drinks at the end of the auction, and besides, the young woman at the reception desk had long legs and a pretty smile. As for the items to be sold, he enjoyed looking at them and imagining the stranded sailors who had been carrying them here and there until they were washed up on this final beach. All through the session, sitting with his hands in the pockets of his dark blue wool jacket, he kept track of the buyers who carried off his favorites. Often this pastime was disillusioning. A magnificent diving suit, whose dented and gloriously scarred copper helmet made him think of shipwrecks, banks of sponges, and Negrolesco's films with giant squid and Sophia Loren emerging from the water with her wet blouse plastered to her body, was acquired by an antique dealer, whose pulse never missed a beat as he raised his numbered paddle. And a very old Brown and Son handheld compass, in good condition and in its original box, for which Coy would have given his soul during his days as an apprentice, was awarded without any change in the opening price to an individual who looked as if he knew absolutely nothing about the sea. That piece would sell for 10 times its value if it were displayed in the window of any maritime sporting goods shop. The fact is, that afternoon, the auctioneer hammered down Lot 306, a Ulysse Nardin chronometer used in the Italian Regia Marina, at the opening price, consulting his notes as he pushed up his glasses with his index finger. He was suave and was wearing a salmon-colored shirt and a rather dashing necktie. Between bids, he took small sips of a glass of water. "Next lot? Atlas Maritimo de las Costas de España, the work of Urrutia Salcedo, number 307. He accompanied the announcement with a discreet smile, saved for pieces whose importance he meant to highlight. An 18th-century jewel of cartography, he added after a significant pause, emphasizing the word jewel as if it pained him to release it. His assistant, a young man in a blue smock, held up the large folio volume so it could be seen from the floor, and Coy looked at it with a stab of sadness. According to the Claymore catalogue, it was rare to find this edition for sale, since most of the copies were in libraries and museums. This one was in perfect condition. Most likely, it had never been on a ship, where humidity, penciled notations, and natural wear and tear left their irreparable traces on navigational charts.
We've just heard The Nautical Chart by Arturo Perez Reverte. Readers, hopefully we've excited some passion in you to experience the rich variety of Spanish authors. Their magical realism, their unique way with a story, their vibrancy is so spellbinding. And now so many of their top authors are available in translation. For more suggestions, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us on this exploration, and see you back here next week on The Book Report. Adios!